My name is Jim Penrose. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of BlueVoyant, a cybersecurity firm based in New York City. I spent 17 years in the service of the U.S. government as part of the National Security Agency. I was one of the founding members of the NSA Threat Operations Center. And then eventually I was recruited to be the technical director of all counterterrorism operations at NSA, where I did that job for 3 years, culminating in playing a small role in finding Osama bin Laden and bringing him to justice. Here at BlueVoyant, I spent the majority of my time working on our third-party managed cyber risk service.
Welcome to the Smart Energy International podcast, your guide to innovation and trends in the global power and energy sectors.
Cybersecurity risk management is no longer just about protecting your operations. Managing third-party vendor cyber risk is fast becoming the defining cybersecurity challenge of our time. The increase in the number of suppliers we engage with as the digitalization of the energy sector progresses means that enterprise networks are becoming increasingly vulnerable to the vulnerabilities of these partners. Simply put, the extended ecosystem is the threat. In a cyber threat environment where adversaries are well-resourced, sophisticated, and relentless, a breach of a single one of what may be thousands of affiliated vendors can have a catastrophic impact. The interdependencies between businesses means an attack on a vendor who may be deemed unimportant to a primary organization can quickly spread with devastating consequences. I'm your host, Claire Falkvane, and today we're talking with Jim Penrose, a former NSA senior leader and COO of cybersecurity firm BlueVoyant. BlueVoyant have just released a report, Global Insights, Supply Chain Cyber Risk, which is one of the reasons that I've invited Jim to this episode. Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Claire. It's a pleasure to be here.
Cybersecurity is, of course, one of the biggest challenges facing utilities at the moment, and a topic which many think doesn't apply to them. Perhaps you could start by explaining what supply chain risk management is and why it's so important.
Yes, supply chain risk management is critically important today, now more than ever, given the situation we have with the pandemic. If you think about how everyone is working from home these days, there's going to be a tremendous expansion of the network access and the resources available to employees who are going to now work from their home locations instead of offices. The energy sector is really no different. Certainly there are, production energy generation stations and other kinds of production activities where you do need to be on site, but there are a lot of employees that can continue to work from home. The extended ecosystem of vendors and suppliers that an energy company uses is going to be no exception. They are going to have a lot of employees working remotely, and that's going to increase the attack surface for the overall energy company. So think back to, all of these different, organizations that you might have given access to, whether you're trusting them to do remote IT support, or maybe it's another kind of software package that you're installing in your network remotely or giving access to a support team so that they can fix problems on your behalf. All of those different vendors have some level of trusted access and present a means into your network. When we did the survey, we looked at about 250 CIOs, CISOs, and CPOs from the energy sector, and we saw that they attributed 79% of them actually had a compromise that originated from their supply chain in the last 12 months. This is really a striking number, and it's went up significantly over the last year. So I see this as a burgeoning threat in the space, and it's something where an operational third-party cyber risk program is really imperative to combat those threats coming from the suppliers in the energy sector.
When you say a cybersecurity risk program, could I ask you to perhaps just expand on that a little bit?
Sure. Well, if you think about all the different aspects of managing cybersecurity risk, there's a number of best practices that are well understood. Like you need to have a global risk and compliance set of questions that you ask any particular vendor that's going to work with you. Are they implementing the best practices like multi-factor authentication and patching, vulnerability management, things of that nature. And those provide, a point in time assessment, like by a questionnaire, as to how those vendors are doing. Of course, there's a limitation on things that are point in time. That means that when you ask a you know, a point in time question, you're going to have, what, 12 months in between the time that you get the next assessment. And then moreover, a lot of companies kind of know what answers that you're expecting. Like, oh yeah, sure, we do multi-factor. They're never going to say we don't, because they know that'll be a problem during the oversight process. So the next step is to bring in, you know, security data or some, say, cyber risk scoring information to be able to bring in, you know, a view that's closer to real time, right? Now, the challenge is when we went back and looked at the answers from these CIOs and CISOs in the energy sector, they were saying that only, you know, it was about like every 6 months that they were coming in and checking some of that data from external sources, you know, like security risk data or cyber risk scores. And then that problem was, you know, too much, you know, what I would call dark space in there where a bad thing could happen in a particular vendor ecosystem, and then an attack could be routed through one of the vendors. So I would say that, you know, while that's, you know, helpful to have security data or scoring data, really, you know, looking at it more frequently, like on a daily basis, is really a critical part of the program so that you don't get, you know, caught flat-footed or blindsided by a particular, you know, risk that's coming through one of the vendors. So thinking of going and taking the current approach and making it operational, that means literally having people checking on a daily basis the vendors in the ecosystem to see if there's a burgeoning risk, and then reacting to that and really driving risk out of that set of vendors. That's really the call to action when it comes to having a robust program. And when I think of, you know, the examples that we're dealing with, there's like a natural cut line that you know, a company wants to draw. Risk managers want to say, hey, you know, these tier one vendors we work with are like big guys like Amazon Web Services or IBM or Siemens or whoever. Those companies have really great security teams, and they've got a lot of people thinking about vulnerabilities and managing them. And I would say that, you know, if you just draw your cut line at that higher part of the ecosystem or the so-called tier one vendors, you're going to actually overlook a long tail of risk in the smaller vendors that may not have anybody on their security team, and frankly may just have, you know, an IT representative that moonlights as security. Those are the ones where the long tail of risk exists, and we, you know, in our experience have seen the attacks routed through those smaller players, because they naturally are going to be that, you know, area outside the bullseye, if you will, that a bad guy's going to shoot at.
And when you say, you know, that you need to consider some of the smaller vendors, what about sort of legacy systems that perhaps are on your network that you're not even aware of are still there?
Certainly. I think in the context of the smaller vendors, a lot of those legacy systems can really be exposed out there over time. So let me just give you some real examples so that we're talking about things that make sense here. In the context of smaller vendors, think of, you know, the exposure of, say, a Windows file sharing capability like SMB, for example. That really shouldn't ever be exposed on the internet. And we know that there's been a number of exploits that were literally pure remote exploits that could go after that kind of service. When we took a look in our data related to mid-sized energy companies, we saw that about 15% still had some exposure with this kind of Windows file sharing directly to the internet. This is not good, right? Because even if there's no, you know, immediate, you know, exploit from, say, the Shadow Brokers tools or, you know, Eternal Blue or any of that, there's still the ability for attackers to take, you know, a known username and password and, you know, log into that share and then start to, you know, create modifications in the files that can Trojanize, you know, machines that run programs when they log into the Windows network. That's the kind of thing that presents a really substantial risk, and you never want to leave those kinds of exposures out there. Those are really important aim points for attackers that are ultimately going to compromise, and many times through your supply chain. So when I think of, you know, legacy systems that you're talking about, there are a lot of exposures out there. And some of those, you know, may have to be, you know, continuing on the net because they're operating critical systems. Completely understand that. Whether you expose them externally to the global internet as an aim point, you know, for an attacker that's going to look for a way in, is a completely different question. And of course, your vendors, you don't want your vendors in the same right exposing those kinds of those legacy systems online, because they will be attacked. And certainly, you know, the skill of the attacker isn't necessarily like, you know, a state-sponsored hacker. You don't need to be, you know, the Russian security service or the Chinese military to be able to figure this out. Really, you just need to be an above-average Googler, if you think about it, right? Go look for, you know, the configuration of the software that's exposed online, responding on a certain port. Google for that, and you can many times find the step-by-step exploitation instructions on how to, you know, hack your way in. So don't assume, it would be erroneous, to think that you need to be a super duper hacking expert to be able to get your way into those networks. Really, you just need to be an above average Googler at the end of the day.
I think that's the really scary part, is that everybody assumes that, you know, you have to have like some serious tech skills to be able to do this, but actually it's just about finding that one little exploitation point that you as a utility, for instance, or a company just can't protect all of your borders all of the time. So that, I think that's the really scary part for me.
Yeah, I wouldn't make it a fatalistic kind of problem. If you think about it, there's really a few basic approaches that the attackers are going to take, especially when it comes to this concept of shooting outside the bullseye. So think of the bullseye as your energy company, right? That's where the bad guy wants to gain access. You've got a team. Your team's pretty competent, defending yourself. They have a SOC, a security operations center, and you've got your incident response plans. You're doing a good job. But at the end of the day, you trust certain people and they have access to certain assets. You don't want that trust to be violated, right, by an attacker who gains access to one of your key partners, right? So you have to expand your field of view, look at those partners and see if they've got an obvious problem. And what's the attacker going to look for when they're shooting outside the bullseye? What obvious problems? Well, first off, they're going to look for all those login portals that are being exposed by your vendors, right? Think of remote desktops, right? Many times, an attacker can just get a username and password that they have, compromised in a data breach from somewhere else, and then use those same usernames and passwords in the remote desktop portals, of your vendors. Those just shouldn't be exposed out there. If you think about it, it doesn't logically make sense to just have it wide open on the internet. There should be, a requirement, right, to have the users of those remote desktops, say, go through a VPN, right, so that it's just not there as an immediate aim point on the internet. And then, of course, anything like your VPN gateways need to be protected by multi-factor authentication, 100% enforcement, right? No kind of self-service system where people can click later or next time, forever, because the people that are clicking later and next time inevitably have their password compromised, and then the hackers, complete the job and finish their multi-factor provisioning, and then they're off to the races, right? So there's a lot of exposure there, and what you want to do is take those I'll call them layups away, or the easy attacks away from the bad guys, where they can just reuse passwords and usernames that have been compromised through those open web portals. If you take those away, that's going to make the bad guy want to run like a spear phishing attack to try to get some credentials that are fresh for those exposed web portals that are out there. So again, just not exposing the all those login portals to the global internet, in your vendor ecosystem, just literally attacking that part of the problem will make you more secure. And from an overall perspective, thinking of your ecosystem and where the cyber attackers are going to focus. And then, if you really, want to go to the next level, you have to, of course, watch what's coming out in the news when it comes to new vulnerabilities, right? Think of, things that are ripped from the headlines on a routine basis where there's a new vulnerability in, say, a Palo Alto. These are the kinds of things where you need to, have a team that's dedicated to watching for that and then saying, oh, this vulnerability is something that, could be exploited in my vendor ecosystem. How many of my vendors have that problem, and can I bring it to their attention to make sure they don't just overlook it and let days or months go by where they could be exploited? Because ultimately the attacker, the cyber attacker, will land in their network and then pivot toward you and try to exploit the trust.
Now, in your report, there were some fairly alarming results that you mentioned. For instance, the percentage of people who felt that they would be able to identify if they had been subject to a supply chain compromise of some sort. Can you perhaps expand on the report and those results?
Sure. Well, in our report, we had this statistic that said 30% have no way of knowing if a risk emerges in their third party. That's a pretty alarming stat. I mean, if you think about it, you want to have a sense of whether or not there's ongoing compromise in your vendor ecosystem or the suppliers you're working with, just because in some cases you have to take some controls on your side, compensating controls on your side to defend yourself from those particular vendors. And then of course you could follow up with questions and inquiries with the vendor who might be illustrating that they've got a compromise. So being able to do that means that you have to have a cyber risk management program that includes those kinds of, you know, cyber analytic data that can be used to give you tips, right, that your vendors have a compromise. So step one is you have to have that kind of, you know, service up and running, and you need to be able to look at that data on a routine and daily basis. And you know, if you're going to be overwhelmed, you're going to overwhelm yourself with that much data. You have to find a partner or some kind of managed service that can take that on, because it's not the kind of problem that you want to put off and let it go for 2 weeks or a month, because ultimately that's the time in which, you know, an attacker would pivot. So that's one of the alarming stats that I really focused in on. And I think ultimately, you know, you want to have a daily cadence in terms of reviewing, you know, the information about ongoing compromise in the vendor ecosystem. Then of course, you know, making sure that if there's a vulnerability that comes in from the headlines, that you can act on that in a timely fashion to drive it down. And ultimately driving down risk is the name of the game here, right? You need to actively engage with the vendors and the suppliers in your ecosystem. Note to them that you can see the problem, like these Windows file shares or remote desktops, and then work with them to increase and tighten down their security controls so that the exposure is no longer there. That's what you know, a robust program looks like. And ultimately, it's not about just identifying the risk. You need to really take action against it. So you've probably seen these commercials on TV that talk about having a dental monitor, right? The dental monitor walks into the dentist's office, and the guy sitting in the chair, he looks at his mouth and says, "Oh man, that's a terrible cavity. You should really do something about that." He takes off the gloves and then walks out. And the guy sitting in the chair, like, "What, you're just gonna leave me here?" Right? and essentially, you know, the whole reason that story is funny is because you should do something about it, right? Like, if you're running a third party cyber risk program, just knowing that there's a risk, identifying it, logging it, and cataloging it, is not doing anything material to reduce the risk, right? You need to be actively engaging and driving the risk out of your ecosystem. Otherwise, you're as good as a dental monitor coming in and saying, "You have a cavity, but I'm not going to do anything about it."
I thought I'd just mention it to you, but, you know, we don't need to worry about it now.
Exactly. You definitely need to worry about it now. That's the whole imperative here. That level of urgency is what a solid, you know, senior leader is going to bring to a firm on this topic.
Are you able to share some examples, perhaps, of recent supply chain related issues?
Yeah, absolutely. And when I think of things ripped from the headlines, I'll give two examples. Recently, there was a problem with Palo Alto Networks PAN-OS. It came out in early September, and essentially it was a remote code execution vulnerability that had to do with, you know, essentially multi-factor logins and the captive portal associated with that, you know, VPN, you know, device. And this is a big deal, because if you can get into, you know, one of those kinds of firewalls, VPNs that protects the network, that can create a massive sort of, you know, pathway for an attacker to move into a supplier's network and then ultimately back to your network. So you don't want to allow that kind of thing to persist in the network. And indeed, we've seen this in the energy sector and the supply chain for the energy sector, that there was, you know, hundreds of different suppliers in that space that had this vulnerability and it was active, right? In other words, if you went and, you know, double checked and did the more specific kinds of scans necessary to get down to ground truth, you could see that configuration was indeed vulnerable. And that's the sort of thing that, you know, as a risk manager and as a cybersecurity professional, you have to jump on very quickly, because, you know, ultimately, that's a very direct access, to, you know, to a supplier's network and can become a immediate pivot point, right, to attack your network. So those kinds of things happen, right? And they happen, frequently, but you have to have situational awareness, right? Or you need to depend on somebody that's going to stare at those, you know, feeds of vulnerabilities from the US CERT or from the UK National Cybersecurity Center. You know, there's going to, you know, be data like that coming out that needs to be, you know, actioned. And when I say actioned, I mean, you actually have to go check your supplier ecosystem and see if there's suppliers that have these problems or these vulnerabilities. It's not good enough to just sort of send out an all points bulletin and say, "Hey, everybody, you should watch out for this PAN-OS vulnerability." People don't actually know how to check, right? I mean, I'll be really plain, right? They just literally don't know how to run the check to see if they're vulnerable. And in many cases, they might think that they're not vulnerable. Being able to take that as a case and manage that case through to conclusion where the remediation is completed, those are the firms that distinguish themselves as being really good at this and operationalizing third-party risk. So that's my first example.
Second example I would give is an example of old Outlook web access portals that are exposed online. This is still quite prevalent. And early in February of 2020, there was another remote code execution vulnerability for those kinds of servers online, those kinds of portals online. And essentially, all you needed was one, you know, pair of credentials, username and password, that would work on the portal, and then you could get, you know, remote code execution, you know, as part of that exploit. That's a pretty big deal, right? Because if you leave those exposed online, what's going to happen is, essentially, you look through, you know, the attacker looks through data breaches and tries to find some credentials that work. Once they do that and they get a foothold in the network, generally those servers are in a pretty sort of key position and are in close proximity to other things like domain controllers and other key resources like file shares on the network. And it provides a very sort of glaring, attack vector for the cyber threat actors that want to go into those, particular suppliers, gain a foothold, and then move forward to gain access to your company, your energy firm. So, I take those two examples as ones that are, recent headlines that we found to be quite substantial and prevalent in the energy supplier space.
Is this kind of, extended focus or optimized focus on supply chain risk management? What does it mean from a cost perspective, both for your suppliers, because they're going to have to go into their supply chain, at just like you're going into your supply chain. So, what does it mean in terms of cost and the ability to roll out things quickly?
Well, I think, again, what you don't want to do is make the problem feel so daunting that you can't take it on, right? So mm-hmm. What I'd like to do is try to say, what can I do? What action can I take that's within the scope of, my vendors and suppliers that they'd be able to, withstand, if you will, in terms of a resource commitment, and with that action materially reduce risk for my own firm and then ultimately down the chain to the suppliers themselves. And so what I like to do is say, hey, everybody that's working in the space, don't try to solve all the risks at once, right? I know you might have a 100-page report that say, here are all the exposed vulnerabilities or other kinds of misconfigurations, you can see from the outside. Instead of doing that, just work on the critical ones first, right? Take away your exposed, SMB Windows file sharing or VNC for remote computer control, or exposed, ICS or SCADA ports that are still out there that can be, touched immediately from the internet. These are things that can be policed up with what I think is a fairly modest investment of resource. With that modest investment of resource, you can get your supply chain to what is largely a nominal state. Now, sure, there might still be some high risk situations or misconfigurations to be improved upon, but taking away the routine avenues of exploitation is always job one in this case. Just make that investment up front and ultimately. If it's like I would need to have 2 full-time employees or 3 full-time employees to take this on, just do the simple math, right? Total up the cost of their salaries and then look at the cost of outsourcing that or bringing in a managed service to run the traps and manage those cases for remediation. You might find that with a fairly, modest investment from a managed services perspective, you can have somebody else, right, do the blocking and tackling day by day for you, right, to reduce that risk in the supply chain. Mm-hmm. And then you can keep the people who are on your staff reserved for the exceptions, right? Think of the exceptions like this vendor refuses to fix their, Windows file sharing that's exposed online. They just completely unresponsive, 3 weeks of getting pinged and not even a peep back from them. If that's true, that's an exception that your team internally is going to want to handle, right? You're going to want to talk about whether they can still be a supplier, or if there's going to be a contractual, issue that's escalated related to the business terms by the business owner, right? That may very well be the means to get remediation executed is escalation through the business path. But what you don't want to do is consume that entire team that would deal with those exceptions with security data analysis, right? That is better done, by a team that's dedicated, that understands that kind of data and knows how to triage it and manage those cases. And then what, if they close up those exposures naturally, that's a non-event, right? The risk is just reduced and those vendors go back to the nominal state and your internal team doesn't even look at it, right? You're just like, oh, good. The, you know, that's now below the risk threshold and I'm happy, but I'll deal with the exceptions internally. So again, my, you know, strident, you know, encouragement here is look for the way to take that specific, you know, specialty and outsource that bit and then leave your team to go after the exceptions.
And if you were to offer advice to say, I think especially the smaller utilities, you know, the big ones have really been able to, I think, dedicate resources and teams to managing cyber risk. But some of the smaller utilities, I think, have definitely had more challenges from a resource perspective. And what would your advice be to them? I guess just, you know, thinking about how they would start to tackle this and just really what would you advise them to do?
Well, you know, when you're looking at an ecosystem of vendors, the natural reaction is to say, I just don't want to know the data that would lead to, you know, possible compromise or a problem in my supply chain. So what I've noticed in the marketplace is some of the smaller players, what they do is they naturally just constrict the number of vendors they're going to monitor for this kind of situation because they don't want to know about a cyber risk that they can't act on, right? Because then if there was ever a compromise, there would be, you know, kind of that process of going through and saying, well, who knew it and why didn't you act, right? And nobody wants that kind of recriminations process, you know, to be, you know, the way that, you know, they identify who didn't do their job or whatever, right? So instead of thinking it in that way of managing risk, like your own personal risk, you know, refocus on managing the energy company's risk, managing the firm's risk, and figure out with the budget I do have, how can I look at that broad set of vendors, right? That long tail of risk I talked about initially, right? Because you don't want to draw the cut line too high. If you do that, you're just going to like create your own blind spot. How do I get rid of the blind spot, but also get to a steady state where we're actively engaging and driving out the risk? Looking at the equation in terms of the operational expenses and the headcount and the salary, you know, that you're paying to your staff, you need to find that sweet spot where you can actually, you know, find a way to engage or have an outsourced provider, say, engage directly with those vendors to drive the risk out on your behalf under like what I would call the rules of engagement you set. Because building an internal program, right, if you're going to really build an internal program, you know, you're going to end up investing, you know, substantial money on that. You're going to end up investing $250,000, $500,000 just in the staff costs just to get out of the gate, right? Think of, well, where would I deploy that $250,000 and could I get more visibility and could I work on a larger number of vendors in the ecosystem to actually drive the risk out? When you go through that analysis of alternatives and you look at that sort of total cost of ownership situation, it'll become clear where you can have the biggest impact. But don't think of it as like, well, if I just limit the scope of what I'm going to, you know, and analyze, that'll make it better. All that does is it creates the blind spot and you'll still have the problem at the end of the day. All you'll have is what I call a well-populated excuse matrix about, well, I just didn't have the data, so you can't hold me accountable for that. You don't want to do that, right? You really materially want to reduce the risk. So, you know, run those equations, right? Look at that math and figure out, well, where can I get the most bang for my buck? But with the end state of being risk reduction in the ecosystem, right? You want to make sure that those individual suppliers actually have stopped exposing, right, that Windows file sharing or that remote desktop or that SCADA system at the end of the day. That needs to be taken, you know, inside their firewall or put inside their VPN or protected in some other way so that the cyber threat actors just don't have that immediate aim point to keep attacking it day in and day out. If the result of your plan doesn't move the needle in that direction, move risk down like that, you're really just, you know, you're not investing the money as wisely as you could, right? Because everything else is literally just populating that excuse matrix I was talking about.
So you mean sticking your head in the sand is actually not an excuse?
No. And obviously, you know, my career in the intelligence community has helped me learn this because, you know, we would want to, frequently the question was, if you have this much information about what the bad guys are up to, can you get through it, right? I used to get that question quite a bit. Mm. And I would say, I would rather have the information about what the bad guys are up to and try and, you know, figure out a way to get through that data by using automation and other kinds of high tech, you know, solutions. I'd rather have that problem than not know it was there and then be surprised and have people get hurt. You know, so it's a similar kind of situation here. And we, you know, I think that that ethos, those core values, if we apply it in this space, will materially improve the cyber risk situation in this marketplace.
If I could perhaps just shift slightly away from supply chain risk and just ask about internal risk. I mean, you know, your staff are obviously a vulnerability, and something that I have become particularly interested in is that whole concept of security fatigue, where people are almost so exposed to or so aware of the fact that you have to be careful that it almost becomes too much to manage. What would your suggestion be? I mean, and have you seen that kind of thinking in organizations that you've worked with?
Yeah, I mean, you see this kind of thinking, and fatigue is a real, it's a real problem, right? And ultimately, we've been focusing in on a zero trust model when we're, providing counsel to companies about how to run their internal programs, where, you assume that there can be compromise, right? Compromised laptops, compromised user accounts along the way, and then you purposely have the security team set these kinds of fire breaks in the system to be made aware of, behavioral activities that would be indicative of a compromised username and password or indicative of a compromised laptop that would be accessing resources it ought not have access to. You want to have a team that's architected a security platform that is able to deal with compromise in those scenarios and actually, questions the paradigm of the hard outside perimeter, but the soft, chewy interior. Mm-hmm. You want to continue to, make it a high, bridge to climb. I mean, on a typical day, I have to deal with, I wouldn't say innumerable, dozens of multi-factor challenges at work, because even as the chief operating officer, we're operating with a zero trust environment. And every time I go to access a key resource, there's a double check to make sure it's really me and it's really, that I can really pass that multi-factor check in those different scenarios with single sign-on and other tools. So all of these different, technical capabilities are really critical to implementing a zero trust model internally. And I think, if I had to put it in a nutshell, that would be the primary approach I would take to counteract the fatigue, because even with the best training and spear phishing education and all those different techniques, I'll tell you that, the average person today is on so many different teleconferences or video teleconferences that whether it's BlueJeans or LoopUp or Zoom or WebEx or you name it, there's so many different tools that when you show up and you're 5 minutes late and it tells you have to download a new application, update it and install it and click yes 10 times, I'll tell you that's like a social engineer's paradise when you have that situation, right? Because as an attacker, and when I would do those kinds of advanced pen tests, that human behavioral trait of just do it, I'm running late, I have to get on these calls, that's exactly how you end up with a compromised laptop that's got access to the VPN and corporate email and all the things that you would ever want as an attacker, right, to pivot and move through a network. So that's what you would do. And of course, you don't want to give people, administrator access to their laptops, and you don't want to give people, that kind of privilege, because if they do end up compromised, that privilege will then be used, right, to try to gain, further privilege in the network. And ultimately, if you're on a Windows network, get to your domain controller and get your domain admin accounts. And that can happen in a short number of minutes. Indeed, it can happen, even within just, a half an hour's time, right, with the right kind of access to the right user's machine that has, Windows domain admin credentials on it. So that's the kind of thing that you would avoid with a zero trust model and having that implemented.
And how does that impact that sort of tension between the your operational imperative and the fact that you need to get work done versus the security imperative? Because I mean, there's always a little bit of tension between those two needs, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is. And when you think about the operational imperative to get work done, many times, people will say and they'll cite, hey, I'm on the road, I need to have access from anywhere on the internet, I can't predict where I'm going to be. And if you have a whitelist of IP addresses to access a certain resource corporately, that's going to make me, kind of dead in the water if I'm trying to access it from the plane's Wi-Fi or what have you. Mm.
I understand that, you know, those can be real, you know, constraints on business. And I think, you know, the recommendation I would give to people who find themselves in that scenario is figure out which of the, you know, corporate VPN solutions that you're using that have the maximum amount of flexibility to be used from these various, you know, platforms, whether they be, you know, plain Wi-Fi or wherever your salesmen happen to be, or your field engineers who are out, you know, in the hinterlands using their mobile phones or whatever to get on onto the, you know, the global network. You know, having a very sort of managed, you know, VPN service or gateway system that's something where, you know, you have to authenticate to that first before getting to the corporate resources largely does, you know, mitigate most of the major risks. And I think it's, you know, based on my experience, it is possible to account for the majority of the scenarios where users in the field are going to have the need to access those resources. And like I said, it could be from planes, could be from, you know, fields where, you know, you're just using your 4G phone or 3G phone, depending on the situation, or maybe even a satellite phone. But these are things that can be configured and operationally, you know, they can be operationally easy to use in a way that people can still get their job done. But just leaving the door open for the entire internet, I can assure you is a risk that will be identified and ultimately a vector that will be exploited by the cyber threat actors, because you know, it's out there all day long, every day. And if there's no restriction on what part of the internet can see those devices or those resources or those portals, it's there for the planning and it's there to be attacked.
On the whole sort of human engagement and interaction element, one of the big challenges that utilities have had is, of course, I guess giving their customers an element of trust that their smart meter or the digital interface perhaps that connects their utility to their home is something that they can trust. What would your thinking be on that, and how would you advise utilities perhaps to, or what would you advise them to do to be able to build that trust with their consumers?
It's a multifaceted problem, right? Because the consumer is going to access various resources online, right, to kind of check their own energy usage and to see how things are, you know, performing, right, and how they compare with their neighbors in terms of energy usage with the smart meters. So that's the web infrastructure part of this I'm going to completely set aside, because I think it's kind of a well-known problem with web applications, web penetration testing, and how you make a good solid web app or an iPhone or Android app. So I'll set that aside, even though it is a big part of the question you just asked, and I'll focus on the devices that are at people's houses. Those devices, you know, anytime you've got devices that are outside your physical control in terms of their location and their network connectivity, there has to be, you know, a lot of planning about the isolation of those devices to make sure that, you know, the network connectivity they're afforded and the overall, you know, kind of functions those devices can perform on the network have some kind of limitation and really tight restrictions on those, you know, those interactions. It's almost like a contract, if you will. And if they violate the contract, the system has to have some safeguards in place to keep them from gaining access to other key resources or jumping to other, you know, network segments where they ought not have access. So I would say that, you know, really taking a hard look at any field devices in the field that are really, you know, running in customer spaces or in a, you know, I'll call it a denied area of some way. In some ways, you know, the utilities devices that are running in customer houses or wherever they happen to be, you know, consumer areas are denied in many ways just due to the privacy facts that, you know, you can't have access and the people can physically touch those devices where they sit. So there's a lot of, you know, merit, right, to, again, sort of taking a zero trust approach there and understanding that any of those nodes at those leaf nodes could end up compromised and be used to, you know, against you to gain access or to try to fiddle with data, corrupt things and gain access to the network.
Do you think sort of running a private utility network would make a difference? Or do you think that ultimately the same restrictions would need to be in place regardless of how that access was gained?
Well, any kind of, you know, private network or special network enclave that's used for these dedicated devices is still going to have some connectivity to the broader resources of the utility, right? So if they're, you know, aggregating data in AWS or some other kind of hosted data center, you know, the data has to get out of that
you know, those limited number of servers and resources that are talking to those, you know, smart meters or whatever dedicated nodes there are, and get into the, you know, the corporate machine, and then ultimately into the web apps and the iPhone apps and the websites, right, where people can see that information. So there's always going to be a way, you know, to get from point A to point B, or from one segment of the network to the other. How carefully you manage that, and whether or not you're using, you know, commercial networks or some other kind of, you know, virtual private network layered on top of commercial networks, I think it's not as, you know, as important as the boundary controls between those segmented networks, to make sure that there really is scrutiny and you know, ways of preventing, you know, an attacker who's gained access to one of those nodes from bleeding into one of your other corporate, you know, critical assets.
Jim, if I could ask, I mean, if there was a message that you would like our listeners to take away with them, what would it be?
I think the message I want to leave you with is there's hope out there. You can actually do something about your vendor ecosystem and the large list of vendors who are, you know, even the ones below your cut line today that aren't tier one, that have those small IT teams and no security people that have these persistent problems. You can actually do something about it, but you have to decide to take it on, right? And if you do decide to take it on, figure out with the budget you have, who you can team up with, right, to do the, what I would call the really, you know, low level ground game work, looking at those results and taking action and managing the cases to close them out so that you can deal with the exceptions, right? This is a tractable problem, right? You shouldn't throw your hands up and say, we're helpless here. You can actually engage and you can actually move the needle in the right direction. And ultimately, when you report up to your CIO or your stakeholders on the board of directors and the CEO, you'll be able to show that you really did measurably, you know, move down risk that's emanating from your vendor ecosystem, and they're going to appreciate that. And certainly your vendors, when you engage and talk about tangible things that are reasonable questions, right, or requests, right, to have them reduce risk, they'll appreciate it too. So, you know, yes, everybody's got resource constraints. Of course, that's a real problem. But people will understand that if you're leaving, you know, Windows file sharing open on the wide internet, that really is, you know, a tangible issue that does need to be addressed. And most, you know, professionals will engage with you respectfully and help, you know, your team to drive that down. And of course, if you don't have the muscle to do it yourself, you know, get help. Bring in a, you know, an outsourced, you know, company or a service provider to help drive that out of the system, and then you just deal with the exceptions where you can't get relief from the vendors. So that's what I leave you with. There is hope, and you can do it.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us. I've really, really enjoyed having the opportunity to talk to you. And I know that I'm obviously, from my perspective, I love this stuff. I'm going to continue watching how risks associated with supply chains are going to be managed, and how, of course, this is going to continue impacting cybersecurity globally. Thank you for joining us on this Smart Energy International podcast. For more podcasts, you can visit the Smart Energy International website at smart-energy.com. Be sure to tune in again for more conversations and insights into the things that matter to our industry. Until next time, I'm Claire Falkvane, and you've been listening to the Smart Energy International podcast.